Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us at Wise Women Media. That was Reggae Got Soul, which is off the latest Playing for Change CD. Great CD. I've got it playing in my car, and there were people from all over the world recording on that particular cut, including Taj Mahal and some other Jamaican artists that you might know of. We want to welcome everybody back for another installment. Tonight we are going to be listening to a pre-recorded interview that I did with Manar A. Muhawesh. She is a Palestinian-American and editor and CEO of Mint Press News out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And she is just, she gives me hope for the future. She's a lot younger than 40 years old. I'm supposed to be interviewing women that are over 40, but she's definitely a wise woman in her own right. So I thought she was an exceptional enough person to be counted among wise women. You can check us out online at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. You'll see links to our social networks, list of our sponsors, archives to all of our shows, and complete show descriptions. Also, let me give a shout-out to Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio that gives us this space every week to do our broadcast, and we are under the Common Project Network. You can find them online. We have a host of different broadcasts throughout the week under that heading. Let me get started without further ado. I just wanted to give you a heads up on Manar and Mint Press News, which is an independent online news source reporting through the lens of human rights and social justice. And the issues that they cover are focused on, issues-based reporting, in-depth investigations, and thoughtful analysis. So if you go to mintpressnews.com, you can see their most recent stories, incredible stuff. And Manar is currently in the planning stages of actually doing her own show and broadcast as well. She was also the first American woman to wear the hijab while anchoring the news in American media. So we're going to be we talked this afternoon about a number of different issues. We covered Gaza and the West Bank, peace in the Middle East, feminism, some of the obstacles and roadblocks that she's come under being a female, just being a female, let alone a Muslim woman reporting the news. So she's had quite a lot of competition out there. She's going to tell us all about that. So let me go ahead and get the audio started. Enjoy, and we'll come back at the end with a song. And in the meantime, if you have any questions or comments, our Facebook page, Wise Women Media, or our Facebook group, Wise Women Media, the radio show, and you can post them there. And I will be sure to respond during the broadcast. So here goes, and I hope you enjoy this. So I want to thank you for being on the show, Manar, and I wanted you to go ahead and pronounce your name so I get it right.
It's Manar. You said it right.
Okay, good. And Manar, for the listeners, Manar is the CEO and chief editor of the Mint Press News, which is a great news resource. I've been looking it over the past couple of days. And, of course, I've seen your interviews with my friend Dennis Trainer. He's had you on several times on his recordings and media shows. So,
he's been amazing. He also does amazing work.
Yeah, he does incredible work for independent media. And, of course, he and I know each other through the Kucinich for President 2008 campaign. But Mint Press News, for our listeners, is found at mintpressnews.com. And you can sign up for the daily newsletter, too. So, Manar, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an editor and CEO of this endeavor and what draws you to journalism.
Wow, I don't even know where to start exactly, but I actually graduated with a broadcast journalism degree several years ago from St. Cloud State University here in Minnesota. But my interest in journalism actually started when I was about 11 years old, when I had lived overseas for 3 years in Jerusalem. And my parents, who are Palestinian Americans, they had moved here in the late 1970s and became citizens and studied here and worked here. We've been here pretty much ever since. They decided to move us over to Jerusalem to kind of learn their culture and their language. And to our great surprise, we had literally moved into a war zone between the Israelis and Palestinians. This was the second intifada had basically started. And I was a really young child. I was 9 years old when we had moved there. And when the second intifada had erupted, I had witnessed, a police state like no other under Israeli occupation. And we had lived with our water cut off. We had lived with our electricity being cut off. And, you know, thankfully, because we were American citizens and held American passports, we were definitely treated a lot nicer than the rest of the Palestinians there. But, it was very traumatizing for me as this young 9 and 10 and 11-year-old girl living in this war zone. I remember crossing through checkpoints and hearing, you know, the driver yell, duck, and we'd have to duck because we'd have to cross because the soldiers were shooting bullets at, like, 9 and 7-year-olds who were trying to cross over the checkpoint just to go to school, just to go visit their family, but they weren't allowed. So I witnessed apartheid. I witnessed ethnic cleansing by the Israeli government of the Palestinian population there. And again, I was really young. I was traumatized. It was too much for my family to handle, so we actually moved back to the United States, back to Minneapolis, Minnesota, where we were from. And I was about 12 years old at the time, and I was completely traumatized. And I had suffered from severe PTSD and anxiety, which I still suffer from today, for the trauma that I had endured and witnessed there under living under Israeli occupation, and having these memories of just seeing, you know, planes dropping bombs on buildings, just knowing that, you know, going to school, half of my classmates couldn't come to school because they were being turned back at Israeli checkpoints. So it was really traumatizing for me. And when I had come back, it was a really key point in my life because, you know, although I was really young, having lived in that war zone, having seen what I had seen, it had really matured me. It allowed me to see the world for what it really and truly was, which is a really dark, a dark place. And I had seen the media portray Palestinians as militants, as these others, and portray Muslims as these, like, barbaric people. And I, you know, looked at my family like, you know, we're pretty normal. And so that's kind of where my passion for journalism came, because I really saw the media and pointed to the media and blamed the media for presenting the conflict in a very unfair way and really treating the Israeli government as this victim when really it was the Palestinians who were being ethnically cleansed until this day. So that's where my passion for journalism started, and that was kind of a long story, but that's really how it started, and I started to freelance, and I started to make press, specifically, to provide a voice to the voiceless, like those that I have left behind. They were never able to share their story, and I wanted to do that, not just for Palestinians, but for people around the world and in the United States.
I think it's important for, you know, our listeners to know that these conflicts are not just happening in Gaza. I know we've spent a lot of time on this show and pretty much throughout all of the mainstream media and independent media speaking about Gaza over the past several months. But,
right,
you know, these things are happening in portions of Jerusalem where there's a large Palestinian population, the West Bank, which is divided up and pretty much walled in many places. And, you know, there, you know, the Palestinians are cohabitating with the Israelis and many other groups, including Christians. And, you know, they're coming in and just creating settlements on what we know of as Palestinian land. And
it's basically Christians and the Muslims and the Palestinians, and they're both equally affected by this occupation, which most people don't really understand. But that is really how it is.
Yeah, and Jerusalem is pretty much a hodgepodge of everybody, but East Jerusalem is where most of the Palestinians in that city live. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's correct, yep.
So you lived in the eastern portion of Jerusalem.
Yes, I did.
And for a long time in Jerusalem's history, wasn't it a place where many, many people from many different faiths worshipped and they lived and cohabitated side by side peacefully?
Absolutely. And, you know, the media likes to convince us that this is a, you know, 6,000-year battle for the land of the Holy Land. But really, throughout history, people have lived there with the exception of, you know, the Crusaders and, you know, under the Ottoman Empire. You know, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, the people of all faiths emigrated there, and they worshipped together. It's been a fairly peaceful place to be where everybody really got along. So it's really unfortunate to see the strife that's happening there now.
Right, right. So when you came back with the PTSD and the traumatization of just living in that environment, did you have to have therapy or rehab to get back into our culture here in this country, or were you able to just do that through your family and your faith?
You know, I went to counseling at school because I just needed somebody to talk to. Because at first, you know, no one really understood what was, you know, I think my whole family was a little traumatized and we didn't really know what it was. We just kind of felt, we just thought it was sadness. We thought it was just a natural thing to feel. We were very, very sad. But as a young child, I went to school and I just needed to kind of vent and let people know what I had been through and what I had just left behind. And unfortunately, here in the United States, most kids in junior high have no idea where, you know, Palestine is on a map, let alone Jerusalem or Israel.
Right.
And they don't really understand what's happening around the world. But I had already had this global perspective about the trauma that war brings to communities. So I did go to school counseling, and I would, you know, talk to the counselor about what had gone on and just really tried to explain to her the trauma that I had endured and the things that I had seen. Personally, it was right after, it was actually right before September 11th when I had arrived. And through my counseling, September 11th had happened, and instead of having the support system from my school counselors, I would find my locker getting checked and myself getting randomly searched because I was Arab, because I was Muslim, and it was like trauma after trauma of being, you know, this victim of this discrimination. So it actually became that year that I had moved was one of the most traumatizing of all of my childhood because I had just come back from this war zone, and then another war had happened. We just had experienced September 11th, which we, you know, our family was just as sad about as anybody else. And then I was also being treated unfairly by the school that I had been to.
Basically, at that point in time, anybody that was Muslim were considered suspects. Whether,
yes,
you know, they had lived here for years or whether their family had lived here for years, whether they were a citizen or a non-citizen or even had their green card, they were considered a suspect and really put under watch by many, many people and agencies, of course. So
exactly.
It was a fine time, you know.
Yeah, and I was only 12 years old at the time. I think I had just, I mean, I was turning 13. And so, I mean, no kid should have, you know, to feel suspect of anything. And I was just a young girl in junior high here in suburbia, Minnesota. So it was really traumatizing. And people that talked to me now, they're like, oh, you're a really happy and smiley person. You talk about all these things you went through. How did you overcome this? And you just kind of have to find that light at the end of the tunnel and stick with it and kind of find that strength within yourself to overcome those things and try to bring truth. And that's why I've dedicated my life to journalism, because if it weren't for the media, these things would have never happened. You know, the media's role is to educate people, to hold those in power accountable, and really set the stage for, you know, providing truth in these issues. But the media wasn't doing that, so it kind of brought us into living into this fear in the United States, that where I, as a 12-year-old child, and many other Arab Americans were treated as suspects, which was extremely unfortunate.
Where do you think we stand as far as our mainstream media in this country in regards to the whole situation with Israel and the Palestinian people? Because everything that I see, and I'm just going to tell you what I see, and then you can tell me what, you know, your perspective. I see that it's almost like everything that Israel says is like doublespeak. From the book 1984, it's like it's almost like all the blame and everything gets shifted to the Palestinians, no matter what. Anything bad that happens over there, the Israelis pretty much make themselves out to be guiltless. And I'm not, of course, I'm not talking about the whole country. I'm talking about Israel's leadership, not,
right,
you know, specific people, because there are so many peace-loving Jewish and Israeli people. That's for certain sure. So I don't want to put everybody in a cookie cutter. So tell me what you think about that, or the perspectives you have on that as a Palestinian woman and a Palestinian journalist.
Well, it's really a double-edged sword, because the media is controlled by corporations. Is the way the media is run is by a business model rather than in the interest of the public. So we have Israeli lobby groups, we have Israeli PR groups, We have AIPAC, which is other lobby group. We have also corporations that are tied to the U.S. government. We have the U.S. government as well who have hired, who have journalists that work for them who are working in the corporate media. So the media is not working in the interest of the facts on the ground, the reality on the ground. They're working in the interest of these lobby groups. And money talks in politics, and money actually talks in journalism too, unfortunately. So what we've been presented with in this conflict for the past 6 years, but especially in the past crisis in Gaza, is that it's an equal level playing field between Israel and Hamas, and Israel is this victim to this rocket fire and this terrorism, these barbaric people, these Palestinians, and Israel has the right to defend itself. In fact, Israel has said, well, look at Hamas and the Palestinians. They don't want Israel to exist. They want to do everything in their power to make sure that Israel is wiped off of the map. But if you actually look at the facts on the ground and the reality of the situation, since Israel has established itself as a state in 1948, it has been ethnically cleansing Palestinians through massacres. The most famous one is the Deir Yassin massacre from the early inception of Israel when they invaded and took over the country. And what's happened in Gaza recently has also been attributed as a massacre because so many civilians had died in this three-week bombing. So these are the facts on the ground, is that Israel has been doing whatever it can to make sure that the native Palestinian population does not exist. In fact, Israel's map has been expanding and growing, and the Palestinian map has been shrinking. There's that famous map that shows the map of Israel and Palestine from 1948 to now, where you can see kind of how the Palestinian map has shrunk. So if we look at how this ethnic cleansing, the civilian death on the Palestinian side, it's ethnic cleansing on behalf of Israel. And really what the Palestinians in Gaza are asking for is a lift of the siege. Just like any colonial power, they're going to ensure that the native people don't have access to the fundamentals to survive, and people in Gaza are literally saying that they're starving, and we're not showing that picture. Fortunately enough, because of social media and because of independent journalism outlets, we've been able to see the true realities on the ground in Gaza and in the West Bank, as well as of the way the Palestinians live.
There was an extremely eloquent Irish senator that was captured on YouTube, and I'm not sure when he did his talk, but it was recent, maybe within the past several weeks. His name is David Norris, and I believe he's the only gay senator in Ireland. What an eloquent man. He stood up and spoke, and one of the main points that he said at the very end of his talk, you can find it online. Anybody that's listening can put in Senator David Norris and hear his whole talk. But at the end, he said he could not believe that Israel controlled to the point of how much food was let in Palestine, because he was going to put the Palestinians on a diet. And
exactly.
This man just had the most righteous anger. It was like the whole time you're hearing him speak, you're cheering him on because he's saying, I'm for humanity and I will never change my view. And I thought, oh my God, he better settle down or he's going to have a heart attack, because I thought he was like almost to the point of screaming his words, you know. But he said, where is the humanity in this, where we're putting the Palestinians on a diet? And
modern colonialism is, suddenly visible throughout the world today, but never has it been so clearly manifested as it was in Israel's latest incursion into Gaza. And I actually just finished up a project, and it's published on our website. It's called The Genocide in Gaza, The Legacy of Modern Colonialism. And it talks about the siege and the starvation of the Palestinian people in Gaza, and it also describes this latest incursion, as I just said, on Gaza as genocide, because that's exactly what it is.
I've been using that word now for at least a month on my Facebook page, and I've lost a few friends because of it too. People have literally unfriended me on Facebook because I used that word, and I said, well, you have to look at the definition of the word, and there's no way that it does not picture Gaza, because Gaza is what's happening in Gaza is the perfect example of this word. And another thing in my research, I'm sure you already know about it, is many people think that Israel was formed as reparations after the Second World War. And, of course, in my research, and I have some pretty savvy friends, too, that pointed me in the right direction in my own private research, but I've been looking at the Balfour Declaration and then looking at some videos where, you know, the Israelis were saying that the land of Palestine didn't exist. And there's plenty of still pictures, there's plenty of evidence in video that Palestine existed before the Second World War. There were many people living there. But the Balfour Declaration was the one that confirmed support from the British government for the establishment in Palestine of a homeland for the Jewish people. And this was created in 1917, and immediately after that year, Jewish people from all over were emigrating to Palestine, maybe not in the numbers that they did after the Second World War, but each year the number went up, and more Jewish people. So the Second World War did not cause the emigration that we know. The emigration had already been taking place. And is this something that you've ever touched on in anything that you've written or investigated?
People have asked me all the time, why don't those Palestinians just move somewhere else? I mean, Israel is the only Jewish state in all of the Middle East. Why don't all the Palestinians just go to Syria or Jordan, where all the other Arabs are? And that's like telling Mexicans to move to Brazil. Really, that's really what it's saying. The Palestinians are the native people of the land. They're actually, you know, they're Semites. And that means my ancestors were actually originally Jewish, and they have converted to Christianity and then eventually converted to Islam. Mm-hmm. So that's why that argument, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it's like telling people, Canada, why don't you guys just move to the United States? You know, different culture, different everything.
People to go back to France or, you know, I mean, cause, you know what I'm saying? Because everybody comes from somewhere else.
Exactly. It's extremely racist when people make those statements. But, you know, I don't blame them. You know, the media has inundated us with that kind of narrative. But the whole idea of Zionism really didn't start until the late 1800s. Because there were Jews in the land of Palestine, and they're Palestinians, but they're Jewish. And they lived together with the Palestinian Muslims and the Palestinian Christians, and everything was just dandy. But that idea, this Zionist idea, is a European idea, and it's unfortunate because it had this belief that, you know, that the Jewish people had to, you know, come back to this land and basically take out all these people out of the land so that they can make it their own state. And if we look at what's happening in Iraq, now I'm not trying to compare Israel with ISIS, but that's kind of what ISIS is actually doing. They're trying to establish, they have this extremist ideology where they want to establish this Islamic state where the majority of Muslims will not tolerate. We will not stand with ISIS. We will not say that, you know, we have the right to go kick out these historic Christians out of Iraq. Start this Islamic state. It's absolutely ridiculous that they're doing this. But this is an idea of colonialism. It's what the Europeans did here in the United States. We believe that it was our land. We had to kick out the Native Americans, ethnically cleanse them, because all colonial powers have three goals. Number one, it's to ensure its own existence over the existence of its native population. And that's what we're seeing, that's what we've seen throughout history. The second goal is to annex as much land as possible to continue the occupation and expand the new colony. And the third goal is to crush any kind of resistance and strength among the populations occupying. And that's why they use terror to terrorize the people of the land.
And it's all through history, and so many people forget. And of course, now they're not even teaching half of this anymore. But, you know, I remember the big term. This came up in our show last week when I was speaking to a First Nation woman, Robin Ledoux, and, you know, we were talking about the U.S., the American takeover of this continent, and the term that we learned in history back then was manifest destiny. And manifest destiny, of course, was gaining a foothold and moving forever westward to conquer more land. And, of course, to, at the same time, to kick the First Nation peoples off of it and to squash, like you said, to squash any resistance to that. I mean, the Trail of Tears was one answer we had to resistance. You know, move all the natives as far westward, take them out of their environments, which the environments were the only places where they knew to survive.
Right.
Take a First Nation person from the mountainous woods and move them out to a desert. Well, that ensures that they will die. That ensures their genocide. So So we can see that. There's so many examples of that through history, and if anybody wants to learn more about that here in this hemisphere, they can read the history of the world from 1492 to 2000 by Howard Zinn, one of the most incredible historians, who talked a lot about the colonialism that occurred.
And if you look at a lot of these conflicts, I mean, on the outside, they appear to be religious, like, you know, the Jewish state with ISIS, it's the Islamic state the Europeans coming on this land. They really believe that because they were God's people, they were the Christians. The Crusades, the same thing with the Crusades. They fought in the name of Christianity, in the name of Christ. I think that's really just to gain to get that emotional impact and get people on board, but at the root of these occupations or at the root of a lot of these new colonies, I mean, religion has nothing to do with it. I mean, you don't kill in the name of a prophet that, you know, that says wage peace, not war. It just doesn't make sense. And I think that's, again, just to grab people's attention and for recruiting purposes. I really don't think it has anything to do with religion. It's for, again, just land grab, expanding a colony, and for power.
Yeah. Explain to people who might not know what Hamas is and why the Palestinians do not, as a rule, support Hamas. And then the other question that I had this week from somebody was about the Hamas charter. And I thought, the charter's been changed over and over again for Hamas, but Hamas is considered the democratically elected government of the Palestinians, but yet they're not elected by majority rule because 50% of the Palestinians are children and don't vote. So explain a little bit why there's such a disparity in who they are and what they are.
Well, I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about Hamas because I really look at this crisis. I look at the bigger picture of, you know, colonialism and genocide and this issue as a whole and other issues around the world. I mean, we don't just focus on Gaza. We focus on a lot of conflicts in the world as a human rights crisis. So I don't know if I'm the best person to talk about Hamas. I do know that they are the democratically elected government of the Gaza Strip. I know that they are the ones who provide, you know, they're the ones who build the hospitals and the schools for the people of Gaza, and the people of Gaza support them. And Israel, of course, views them and has labeled them as a terrorist organization. But from what I also know is that Hamas has, you know, with their recent listing of the siege, they ask for very basic things. You can find this online. You can Google, like, Hamas ceasefire agreement. They ask very basic things about lifting the siege, you know, in terms of, like, being able to travel, being able to allow goods and services to enter into Gaza, things, really basic things like that. But if we read them, you know, we would probably be like, that's all they're asking for, is what people of Gaza want. What's going on here? That was, when once we read that ceasefire agreement, we would know that there's a lot more to the story than what's being presented to us in the media. But again, I'm probably not the best person to talk about Hamas.
Yeah, the charter, I understood some portions of it, but after reading the one from 2006, from before 2006, as I understand it, it's been rewritten many times over. So I'm not sure if the question I was asked by somebody else about Hamas and their charter, if what she was looking at even has anything to relate to what how it reads today. You know?
Sure. I think what they were, and I think I've heard this on the news before, never heard it being talked about, but I'm sure they're referring to the charter that states the extermination of Israel or Israel not existing, which is really interesting that the media tends to focus on that when
right.
we have at least six Israeli politicians just in the last month literally called for a genocide of the Palestinian population
yeah.
and wiping them off of the map. Why aren't we talking about that? And if we're going to look at a charter, are they actually acting on it? I mean, is Hamas literally wiping Israel off the map, or is the IDF literally going into Gaza and wiping people? I mean, we have 2,000 civilians that died in Gaza, 500 of which are children. That in itself equates a massacre, an ethnic cleansing. 10,000 homes were bombed. 10,000 civilian homes were bombed. Hospitals and schools were targeted. That's terror. That's ethnic cleansing. I don't think that what Hamas has been doing to Israel, not that I obviously condemn all rocket fire because peace is the only way to bring justice into the world and to make change. But if you look at what Hamas has done, I don't think that really, it's not an equal level playing field here. Israel is one of the largest
no.
and most sophisticated militaries in the world. It's been compared to Great Britain's military. And then we have Hamas, who has homemade rockets that have caused very little damage.
I've been telling people that, you know, and I made this realization today, which really scared the hell out of me when I thought about it. They sent Timothy Fitch, who was the prior police chief of Ferguson, Missouri, to Israel to study counterterrorism. There was a document that was being circulated on Twitter that I was able to see. Many other people saw it. So the tactics that were used in Ferguson on the streets came from the training that these troops received from one of their leaders going over and actually getting trained in Israel. So those tactics have come home to our streets. And then mm-hmm. the other fact of the matter is we give Israel our, you know, the weapons that we've just developed, and basically what they're doing is they're testing them out.
Right.
And I thought, that is just bizarre. That was a realization that hit me like 10 tons of bricks fell on me. I said, oh, my God, we have the tactics here, and we give them the weapons to use on the Palestinians.
Exactly. I mean, I think Abby Martin from RT had a really great show that basically broke down every conflict in the world and how U.S. military weapons can be traced, that can be found in each one of those conflicts. There's an
right.
arms trade deal happening around the world, and our weapons can be found everywhere. Our fingerprints are in a lot of conflicts around the world.
Yeah, because they were pulling up some casings out of Palestine, like casings from whatever the shelling was that was used in certain areas, and they did have like made in the USA on them, and there were. Pictures that were circulated right from Gaza, you know, identifying those incendiary devices and bombs.
Right.
So very, very frightening that, you know, we have those tactics being used here, and our police departments, of course, have been militarized. So I think that's the biggest, besides Gaza and what's happening in the Middle East and Iraq and I can't help but think Iran is going to be next, and that really, I just shudder to think about that. But it's here in Ferguson, that's like the other big news story, but what the mainstream media is not talking about is the other black men that have died just in the past week. And
mm-hmm.
I think people need to realize I don't know if you've seen the article, but it came out in Alternate some time ago that every 28 hours a black man or boy is killed by either cops or vigilantes in this country. That means, like, if you average it out, it's about one a day. So
yes.
In our mainstream media, we get the tip of the iceberg on that. We only get a few of those stories. We don't get all of those stories.
Absolutely. And I know we've covered the militarization of the police quite extensively since I launched it Press, what, 2 years ago. And one of our biggest reports that we did was that the U.S. police have killed over 5,000 civilians since 9/11. And statistically speaking, Americans should be more fearful of the local cops than terrorists, you know, where, because of just how brutal they've become. It's like we're entering a war zone in our neighborhoods. Why do our police look like they're gearing up for war? I remember about 2 years ago, I went to cover the anti-NATO demonstrations in Chicago, and
right.
I was just shocked. I mean, really, my jaw just dropped to how the police reacted to these demonstrators, and I was there. I was a witness. These demonstrators were holding signs that said peace and love, and people were, like, singing these kumbaya songs, and these SWAT teams came in, and they literally looked like they were just gearing up for, like, World War III. It was so scary, and I was just there as a journalist covering this. But this is the reality of the police state that we live in.
Wow. And, of course, this has been going on for some time. There were the WTO protests. I think they were in 1999 in, I think it was Seattle. That was a big one. And then there were WTO protests pretty much all around the country. And now, of course, they hold them in very secluded places that are logistically very difficult for people to even get close to. And they claim that's for security, but when they held them just in regular conference-type hotels, there were usually super big direct actions outside, so they don't do that anymore. But the other night, watching a live stream of what was happening in Ferguson, they even used the LRAD, the sound machine.
Yeah.
Tell the listeners a little bit about that weapon, because that's an unusual weapon.
Well, I don't know too much about it. I do know that I saw that when I was in Chicago at the anti-NATO demonstrations. Again, it looks like a bulldozer, really, and it releases this sound that, like, really hurts your ears. And you just, I mean, it can damage your eardrums if you're in the area. And I remember when in the anti-NATO demonstrations that I was at, and I'm only bringing this up because I witnessed it myself and I saw it with my own eyes, is they had to clear up the area. And they kept threatening the demonstrators, like, if you didn't leave, even though the demonstrators had permits to demonstrate in that area, that they're going to release that sound. And apparently it can be extremely deafening, and it's like this high-pitched noise where you can't stand the sound.
Yeah, when I heard it the other night, I knew exactly what it was. It was like, you know, of course, I'm watching it on a live stream, so it's definitely nothing compared to, you know,
right.
How the people heard it that were standing right in front of it. So do you have any thoughts on whether these protests in regards to Ferguson are going to end? Do you think they're trying to smooth things over, or do you think they're trying to get us ready for more militant police actions in our communities?
Well, I think it looks like things are trying to smooth over a little bit. The fact that I think the governor had to step in and basically trying to cool down the situation because it was such an embarrassment for how the police had reacted. I know that the governor said it's starting to look like a war zone here and we need to end the violence. And I think that was, you know, a breath of fresh air because we saw the police take in action towards these demonstrators. But I don't think that this is the end. I think what we saw in Ferguson is, what I saw just 2 years ago in Chicago, and I think that we're going to see it again. And a lot of people in many cities across the United States live this every single day. I know that last year, I think it was last year or the year before, I remember, we interviewed an Oakland police, or a veteran, a military veteran who was in Oakland, who was a conscientious objector, I believe, who had been permanently brain damaged from these left and lethal crowd control tactics by these beanbag clowns.
Oh, so, Scott Olson, right?
I believe that's his name, yeah. And this is just, I mean, this is what, I mean, yeah, we might be seeing the situation calm down in Ferguson, but for a lot of people that live in, you know, Chicago, in New York, in Oakland, this is the daily life and just what people have to live with all the time. So we might be seeing things calm down in Ferguson, and the protests might calm down as well, but will there really be justice? Will we really see a change in these military tactics, or I'm sorry, in these police tactics? There you go, Freudian slip. Will we see a difference? I'm not sure, especially considering the fact that, you know, under the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, has allowed for America to become, you know, America's police to become an army.
Right.
So we really have to reform the system from within and at the root of the problem and not look at this as this one polarized issue in Ferguson.
And another thing that we can't help but mention in regards to the militarization of our police forces is the fact that what happens to a lot of our veterans when they come back here, when they have been exposed to the things that they have to do just for their regular duties while they're active duty and while they're at the war front. Then they come back and they get a job with the police force or, you know, with their local government or, we don't know what their backgrounds are when they're on the street. We don't know if they have itchy trigger fingers, if they're suffering from PTSD or other emotional or mental problems or conditions. We don't have any clue, but this could be almost a way to bring trained personnel into the militarization of our police departments across the country and our law enforcement.
I was just talking to the founder of PANDA, which is People Against the NDAA, yesterday. And he mentioned to me that he's very good friends with a military veteran who is going to be traveling to Ferguson to join the demonstrators. I believe it was to join the demonstrators. I don't remember. Or to monitor. I'm not sure. And then he's also good friends with, an Army general who's also going to be traveling to Ferguson to kind of just check out what's happening. And he was mentioning to me that these two people are very passionate about the police to not get militarized at the rate that it has because they both can relate to the equipment and to the weapons that these officers are using as the same that they were using in combat in war zones, and they're wondering why in the hell do we have to arm our police here in these small towns, because not just Ferguson but in our small towns here in Minnesota and North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, with this type of equipment. So I think there's a lot of people out there that are speaking up against it, but the only way to really change that is to fix the system from within and at the root of the problem.
Right. Now, as a Muslim woman, as somebody that has devoted her life to journalism, have you experienced barriers in this country yourself or with your family?
As a journalist, or what do you mean?
As a journalist, as a Muslim woman, you know, as somebody who is a feminist, what kind of barriers do you experience in regards to your work, your family, your faith?
Sure. Well, when I actually first started my journalism career, I started in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is Michelle Bachmann territory.
Oh,
and
boy.
We're all... Yeah, and I had also just started kind of wearing the hijab, the headscarf, you know, for modesty purposes. And I actually grew up not wearing it, and I started wearing it when I was around 19, 20. And when I had lived in St. Cloud and I was doing some reporting there, you know, I was no longer this American girl in the eyes of everybody around me, I was looked at as a Muslim because I had a big scarf on my head. And out of all the places I had started my career was St. Cloud, Minnesota, as I mentioned, in Michelle Bachmann's territory. And, you know, I'm a very smiley person. I'm a very friendly person, very talkative person. And, you know, I don't have an accent or anything like that. So I'm just from Minneapolis, Minnesota. When I had met a lot of these people and I had interviewed them, they just didn't know what to think. You know, I was wearing jeans. I was wearing a nice blazer, a nice shirt, colorful. I was very smiley and cheerful. And a lot of them just didn't know what to think. And I would end the interview with them, and they'd say, you know what? You're really nice for a Muslim. You're really, really nice for a Muslim. And they're like, you know, you're the first Muslim I've met, but, like, I could get along with you. And I would just sit there, and I would talk to them, and it was because they were, you know, living in such a closed-minded community, and they were inundated day in and day out with kind of these stereotypes of what Muslims, and especially women, that, you know, we're oppressed, and we can't think for ourselves, and all of these things. So that was my first experience, and actually, instead of looking at it as a barrier, I took it as an opportunity to really treat people the way I would want to be treated, and that helped open the eyes of many people in St. Cloud, Minnesota. But since I started Mint Press, that's been an interesting journey for me, because the first year that I started Mint Press, I launched Mint Press last year, I actually came under a smear campaign by BuzzFeed and some bloggers from, I think, like the Wall Street Journal or something, I don't remember. And they had conspired that I had some Muslim agenda, and I, you know, there's, you know, somebody behind the press, like my, you know, my family was being pulled into these smears, like my father-in-law, like, because they had conspired that I was just too dumb, and I was just this young woman that couldn't think for herself, so there must be some agenda behind the press. It was really, really ridiculous. And I remember reading these articles and kind of laughing, like, these are so dumb and so xenophobic, like, no one would ever believe this. This is just so outrageously Islamophobic. And that's kind of the kind of thing that I faced. But what I've learned with these experiences is that you can't hold grudges. You just have to smile. Just have to show people who you really, really are, and you know, just continue to be kind to people, speak with them gently, and really be a rose and be a, you know, a flower to everyone, even if they want to crush you, because that's the only way things are going to get done in this world and really make a difference is really through peace, through positive communication.
And you know, Eleanor Roosevelt had a great saying, and I repeat it to people who have been through things like you have and like so many of us have. And it was a very simple statement. She just, and I repeat it often to myself. Her saying was, her line, what you think of me is none of my business. And I thought, you know, when somebody's talking about me and it just makes me furious and they don't have the story right or they've misjudged me or whatever it happens to be, it's like a mantra in my mind. What you think of me is none of my business.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, as, you know, not just because I'm Muslim, but because I'm a woman, especially, I think women are really, we're still getting attacked. We're still victims of sexism. We're still victims of this idea that we are unable to think for ourselves. We're unable to speak for ourselves. And when I was smeared last year, and it was like, you know, the word Muslim and girl kept being mentioned in the article, like, over and over again, like I was just some dumb, you know, young person who didn't know what they were doing. It was just a reflection of this sexism that we face, even by other women. And I was just so disgusted by it to think that even in 2013 and 2014, us women are still being attacked and labeled as such. But, you know, again, all we can do is just speak our minds and continue to fight for the truth. The reason I came under the microscope is because we had challenged the narrative about Syria. We said, hey, we're arming these rebels in Syria, and a lot of them have links to Al-Qaeda. We can't do that. And because we were one of the only newsrooms that challenged the narrative, that's how I became kind of, you know, Mint Press and myself, we kind of came under the microscope. And instead of challenging the narrative of the story, instead of challenging the article that we published, it became a direct personal character assassination which was extremely unfortunate. But these are the kinds of stories that I can share today and bring truth to the story.
Well, that's it. It's the fact that we can't be silenced. We can't allow ourselves to be silenced. And as a journalist, I think that's the most important ethic. And, of course, the other is not to reveal our sources a lot of the times. But, I like doing this show because I can be open about who I'm speaking with and really present a lot of views and definitely not be hook, line, and sinker for what the mainstream media is reporting, which we know is not, you've said it. It's not the narrative, and I even have a new Facebook group called Challenging the Rhetoric, and Robin Ledoux spoke about that last week when I asked her, where do we go from here, what do we do next, with Gaza, with what's happening everywhere else in this country, what do we do, and she, that's the first thing she said was challenge the rhetoric, and she said you have to do it wherever you can, in spoken word, in written word, wherever. So I thought, wow, that's my mission, and I'm sure that's what your mission is too, is challenge the rhetoric and
absolutely. That's our job as journalists, is to question everything. If we don't question everything, then we're just like everybody else, and we're just towing the establishment line. If journalism was truly working in the interest of the people and in the interest of informing the public, then we wouldn't really be having this problem. But journalism in the United States and in many Western nations, has completely turned upside down. It's not working in the interest of us. It's working in the interest of these corporations, again, these lobby groups, and in the interest of the government. It's our job to challenge those narratives.
Right. Where do you go from here, and where do you see yourself in 5 years?
For Mitt Press and myself, I'm actually going to be doing my own online show, which I just kind of started doing, like, basic Skype interviews, but I'm actually going to be, we're building a studio for myself so that I could do really professional on-air shows while I'm sitting at a desk, bring my broadcast skills that I graduated with back to the table, but really bringing truth into the media. There is a huge void right now in truth reporting, and we need to look within ourselves as journalists and say enough is enough. We need to come together, band together, stop attacking each other like what happened to me last year, and bring truth back into reporting and find that moral courage within ourselves. I know a lot of journalists came under smear campaigns, and they were threatened to have their careers ended by government officials, by other journalism entities. We've actually had that happen to some of our own journalists here at Mitt Press. But it's really finding that, catharsis and that vision and mission to bring truth back into reporting and informing the public so that we can help change the conversation about what's really happening, so that we can come up with solutions. We don't just report for fun and because we like this really depressing news. We want to educate the public so that we can make change and fix things for the better. I have a 4-year-old son, and I definitely don't want him to be growing up in a police state, and that's why we cover this issue about Ferguson, for example. We want to make sure that we reform our police system, and he's able to grow up living not in fear, but grow up in happiness and feeling prideful in the community that he grows up with. And that's why we bring attention to the war zone and the horror that some of our foreign aid contributes to. We're creating more enemies around the world than friends. And I don't want my son, again, to grow up in fear, to think that there's, an enemy somewhere out there that wants to kill him because he's an American. My son has big blue eyes, and he's kind of a blondie. Doesn't really fit that Muslim stereotype. But I don't want him to feel threatened because, he's this Caucasian American child because he's an American. So this is the kind of change that we want to make.
Right. Envisioning a new world, one of peace, one of understanding, one of compassion, I think is so important to pass on to the next generation. I don't have children myself, but I'm certainly concerned about the ones that are coming up that are going to replace, you know, all of us when we're gone.
Exactly.
And, you know, creating that legacy is so, so important.
There are so many, young people who feel ostracized from the media. I know I felt for a very long time ostracized, but then I became the first hijabbed, Muslim American woman to report the news on air, and then I, same thing with reporting news. There are a lot of people who have really great strengths that want to contribute in the news media, and the biggest advice I give them is to shoot for the stars. Go for your dreams. Don't let anybody stop you. Don't let anybody tell you that you can't. In the United States, we have something called the American Dream. Although we're getting told that the American Dream has been crushed, we need to really find, again, that moral courage within ourselves and not allow these stereotypes, these labels, these attacks on us, these personal attacks on us bring us down. Because at the end of the day, it's really about bringing the truth back, and that's what we should really focus on.
Yeah. I think we can conclude right here. Thank you so much, Manar, for being a part of the show, and everything you said was just amazing, and you certainly are a beacon in the darkness.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's just, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to be doing, with Mint Press News and your new show, so I'll be watching, and would definitely like to have you come back on again. Thank you so much, and we'll be watching.
Thank you so much for having me. Really, I appreciate it. I really had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you, and good night.
So that was the conclusion of our interview, and wow, it was just amazing. She's an up-and-coming journalist doing great work, and kudos to her, and we'll definitely have her back on. I want to just remind everybody, we'll be doing a show again next Friday, 10 o'clock. I'll be posting more information about that shortly. Check us out at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. And also, we are independent media, so we have no corporate sponsors. Hit us up on the GoFundMe link, and no amount is too small to help us broadcast this show every week and pay for the internet. I'm going to conclude with a song. Manar had told me that she really, really likes reggae, so I had opened up with a really nice reggae song in the beginning, and I'm going to close with one. This is Bob Marley's song, Get Up, Stand Up, as interpreted by Playing for Change, off the newest Playing for Change CD that was just released. It's called Song Around the World. So here it is, Get Up, Stand Up.
God will come from the sky and take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what your life is worth, you will look for your thunder. So no one can see the light. I beg you just to stand up for your right.
Don't you ever give up.